5, Ecclesiastes.
Ooh.
It's a... Ecclesiastes is a very unique book. It's a very tricky book in some regards. So, in Hebrew, the title of this book is Kohelet. Kohelet, which means teacher or preacher. And that's it. Like, that's all the designation you get as far as who is writing this and who this person is. It is traditionally attributed to Solomon. And I'm one of those folks that thinks, well, unless there's a really compelling reason to dispute the tradition, you just go with it. And I have no problem whatsoever assuming that Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes. Yeah. Frankly, I don't have a big problem putting Ecclesiastes together with Proverbs. Mm-hmm. I know they're very different, but I'm kind of okay with it. So we got a little bit of a rationale early on about how Yancey is approaching Ecclesiastes and that distinction between Proverbs. And he kind of even takes some length to say, maybe it wasn't Solomon, but maybe it was kind of reflecting on Solomon or Solomon's era and all that. So just kind of a quick general thought. Where do we tend to fall on the authorship of Ecclesiastes?
I think
Solomon wrote it because of how he... Okay. So when I said that I didn't have a problem with putting Ecclesiastes and Proverbs together, I got that quizzical Tom look. So anybody have any thoughts about that? About both of those books are traditionally attributed to Solomon. Proverbs more explicitly so, but still... why do those two not seem to go together quite so naturally?
Well, for me, they're both sides of the coin.
Okay.
I thought about that when I read the part about is it or isn't it, and I was just thinking, it could very well be just for the simple reason you might sit and write all the reasons why, mm-hmm. and then think, oh, have I really studied this thoroughly, and then go to all the reasons why not? And that's kind of what it seemed like to me.
Okay.
Happened.
I think my reason why I think Solomon wrote it, because of, remember, Solomon had everything, and then he went off on the deep end somewhere. Mm-hmm. So he found out that everything is just plain nothing. Don't care how much you have. So that's why I think that because he said vanities are vanities. When he figured out, I had everything. And then in the end, it's like, oh, wow.
Here I am again in Marion's world, but to me, everybody has everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's how much of it we recognize in truth. We all have everything, but do we really follow the Lord in such a way that we appreciate everything and even those who have in the worldly appearance of everything and those that don't have in the worldly world's appearance of not having everything, there is no difference. It's in the faith that it's in the faith and recognizing the Lord for everything that is here and is not here.
To think about how some of those people that have everything
are
not happy with it.
They're still miserable.
And the ones who have so very little,
they're happy.
They're very happy with so little.
No. So that's what Solomon is saying.
When I was very young in following the Lord, I used to say all the time, why would I want to follow the Lord and suffer? You know, and we're called to suffer with him. And I had a long time of praying and asking, you know, what is the purpose? Why do I want to suffer? And I still don't know the true answer. Why would anybody want to suffer? But the other half of that for me is I don't want to be any place else but in the Lord's hands.
Yeah.
Because it's the only place that's safe.
Right.
And secure.
Yeah.
I
forget which Sunday this was. It wasn't all that long ago. It was within the last month. But I forget exactly what I was preaching on, but I had a quote in the back of my head that I wound up never using at either service. And that happens sometimes. But so my undergraduate degree is in management. I was in business school and took a lot of business classes. And you can't go to business school. I mean, maybe you can these days because who knows what in the world they're teaching in schools. But for quite a long time, you could not go to business school without encountering Peter Drucker. And Peter Drucker was kind of considered like one of the founders of modern managerial theory. Peter Drucker was a practicing Christian and has a quote about why, and he said, because it was the best deal. So you think about,
that's,
you know, like this quintessential
businessman,
famous for business all over the world, and his answer is a businessy answer.
That's right.
It was the best deal.
Yeah.
Now, by that, I am very comfortable extrapolating. That's a very complex answer that is going to be unique to everyone. It doesn't mean that everything is going to turn out great. It just means it's the best deal. Will you suffer? I believe you will. The way of the cross is the way of
suffering.
But it's the best deal for this incalculable weight of glory we are promised. And sort of like you said, where else would you rather be?
Mm-hmm.
So I think these are all kind of very appropriate thoughts in trying to dig through Ecclesiastes, which is in many ways kind of a bummer of a book.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very cheerful. If you're looking for philosophies of life that are, you know, real happy and smiley, this ain't it. So let me ask again. So we asked about sort of any authorship thoughts. So let's kind of poll one another and see, where do we fall on the purpose of Ecclesiastes? What is Qohelet, what is the preacher or the teacher trying to accomplish in this? Is he an old crusty cynic who's just complaining? Is he kind of playing reverse psychology where he actually doesn't believe these things, but he's kind of giving the extreme example so that he can pull you back to the truth at the end? Is it something else? You know, what's going on here? A lot of people can read Ecclesiastes and wonder, why is this in Scripture? Why is this in the Bible? It sort of seems, you know, kind of, you know, very nihilistic or at the very least a downer. So, what's the purpose of Ecclesiastes?
He's telling us that to live our life so that it counts in the end. Because when we live wantonly, just like nothing, and just take everything for granted, in the end, he's saying, well, look, it's going to catch up with us. So live a life pleasing. Because if we go to the end of the book, it said, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter.
Okay.
serve God and keep His commandment, for He shall bring everything into justice. So it's best for us to live our life for Christ, because He said to everything there is a season. We're gonna die. So live for Him. Live for Jesus.
To live every day as if it's the end and to the best.
Hashtag YOLO.
Yes.
I don't know what you
That's
mean
right.
by that.
I was making a stupid joke that it's what they would refer to as a dead meme these days, meaning it's something that was popular too long ago and is now very uncool to bring up. But there was a time where everything was YOLO. You only live once. And so you're supposed to do stuff and say, YOLO! Like, you know, you're supposed to really go for the gusto. So
you were more of a castrate the younger.
Yeah, not so much. Not so much. I mean, that was, that's an old one. And I was using it ironically, so that's okay. So, is the downer element of Ecclesiastes, is it a rhetorical device, or is it honest? Meaning this, the last chapter definitely pulls us back to love and serve the Lord, a life of ultimate meaning, and that's where it's found. Is it tacked on at the end, or is it the legitimate endpoint of this book? Because that seems to be, even Yancey, as he's writing it, he seems a little conflicted.
Yes.
I haven't read the last chapter, so I don't know what I'm supposed to believe as far as the last chapter is concerned.
Oh, of Ecclesiastes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, of the book.
Oh, this
no,
book?
No.
What he's saying is, Yancey seems to write in a way that's kind of equivocating. He's not 100% sure whether the last chapter of Ecclesiastes is a final conclusion or if it's kind of tacked on at the end like he's trying to convince himself it's true.
Well, I think he's trying to convince himself all the way through. When he said he was 75 years old and about to die, I took some concern with that.
Well, hey there!
I'm saying Tom should have taken more. I'm
wait a second now.
I'm not ready to die. And I don't know. But I felt that earlier in his writings that he writes like he's not sure, but then he gives something that says, well, but this is how you're supposed to think.
And this is Yancey.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I always feel like when I get to there, well, it's the Lord is giving this interpretation of through this book to us so that we speak to the Lord himself and know where we're supposed to be with the Lord. I don't think Yancey can tell everybody in the world what they're supposed to think.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether that's rhetorical or what it's supposed to be, but that's how I interpret it.
Okay. Anybody else? Is Ecclesiastes, is the conclusion genuine or is it tacked on?
I don't get the tacked on feeling.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'll give my take, which is that the end of Ecclesiastes is straight up. He means what he writes, but he also means what he writes earlier on. And I will say it in this way, that I don't think he's playing reverse psychology. I just think he's being honest that life is hard.
Presenting both sides of things.
Works
pretty well.
This is not a cheery book, but it feels like a very well-worn, well-earned perspective.
Yeah.
This is not hearing from a teenager that life is unfair. This is hearing from a great-grandparent that life is unfair. They say it in two different ways, and they mean two different things.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I interpreted what you're asking wrongly, I think. You're asking, what is Solomon?
Yeah, about Ecclesiastes.
Yeah.
You were talking about, but that's okay, because what you said about Yancey, I think, is appropriate in trying to figure out why Yancey thinks the way he does about Ecclesiastes.
Yeah.
I think he himself is kind of hedging his bets, because that's sort of his temperament, maybe. I think that Ecclesiastes is a very honest book. It is rhetorical in a sense, the rhetoric is not that reverse psychology of, I'm going to point out the extremes of your position to change your mind.
Yeah.
I think he's being honest that he's tried everything, and it all kind of ends up the same one way or the other.
And if you can't experience the good, you can't experience the bad, and if you can't experience the bad, you can't see the good. You know, there's the whole Bible's written that way.
Yeah.
It's like he's saying, don't do like I did. Did all pleasures in the beginning, but trusting whatever the Lord or whatever.
Well, I want to go back to that kind of a phrase that I used a moment ago, because I think there's something implicit in there that I always think of when I'm reading Ecclesiastes, and that's to hear life is unfair from a teenager versus life is unfair from a great-grandparent. They mean different things. So the words, when it comes from a teenager, always come across as sort of impudent. You know, it's very self-centered, it's very selfish. Life is unfair because I don't get what I want.
Well, it's a very short span of life.
Extremely short.
Yeah, it doesn't have much
experience
to build on.
Yeah, and their experience is, I want what I want, I don't get it, life is not fair.
Right.
The great-grandparent who says life is not fair is rarely talking about the same thing, about I want what I want, I didn't get it. They're more reflecting over a lifetime and seeing that kind of, sometimes you try hard and it doesn't work. Sometimes
yes.
You don't try at all and it does work. Sometimes good people succeed and sometimes good people fail. Sometimes these things happen that are out of our control. Life is not fair. That's a great line from The Princess Bride. Life is pain, Highness. Anyone who tells you differently is trying to sell you something.
Life is what?
Is pain.
Pain.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
So there is an honesty about someone who is, you know, however old, to be able to say, life is not fair. It doesn't have to come with a foot-stomping sense of entitlement. It can kind of come with just sort of a wry sense of acknowledgement. Yep, life is not fair.
That's the way it is.
And I know that. You're going to set yourself up for a lot of disappointment when you start assuming that it is, or you can make it fair.
Yeah, but
it's
those
not.
Disappointments sort of get washed over.
I agree. I think so. I things that seem enormously important
at the time.
You, and kids in particular, lack the perspective to know that.
That's right.
Adults do too.
Well, some of these adults act like they've never had these experiences, or at least they haven't learned anything from them. But like, you know, a teenager goes through something and they feel like, I'm the only person who's ever felt this, and it's so enormous, this must be the way life is now forever. And this is going to change everything. Well, you do that 3, 4, 5, 20 times, and you realize that these things kind of come and go. It doesn't make them unimportant, but it just places them in proper perspective.
In the total, they're insignificant.
Well,
I think so.
I think there can be significance without it being all-consuming.
When I think of back about disappointments in my life,
right?
At the time, they were critical.
Absolutely. Devastating.
Now I don't think I say, oh yeah, I remember, oh well, what the heck, move on. It doesn't mean anything.
Thank you for moving there.
Yeah.
No, that's
I'm only kidding.
So, and this is where I don't feel the existential dread of Ecclesiastes. Because if it's a 20-year-old writing Ecclesiastes, they sound suicidal.
That's right.
If it's an 80-year-old writing Ecclesiastes, they sound like somebody who's seen a lot and done a lot.
Been there, done that.
Been there, done that. Mm-hmm. And you know, an argument should not be true or false based off of the person who makes it. But the thing is, I'm not sure a 20-year-old can speak these words and mean the same thing that an 80-year-old can do. They actually mean different things coming from the source. And it's also why I don't have a lot of problems reconciling Solomon writing both Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Number one, you can write them and both be true. Number two, it's very easy for me to assume over the course of a lifetime, you write different things at different times.
Well, and you would say that this is a period of reflection.
Yes.
In his life.
Yes. You know, picking a chosen field. We could say a teacher just because that's what Ecclesiastes kind of is, but it could be anything. It could be an engineering or whatever. That if you're working on a project for your job and somebody says, well, how do you do that? You might explain it in a certain way. And then you continue to do that job for another 20 or 30 years and you retire. You've been retired for a while. And then somebody who's currently doing that job says, well, how do you do that job? Well, I'll tell you what. I do such and such and such and such, and I did that a few times, but one of the things I learned is, if you also do this, keep in mind, and watch out for this, that reflective quality might change the advice given about something that you would have given differently before. And it doesn't have to be materially different in the sense of, oh, you have to put one on top of the other just completely differently, but it just might be with a sense of context that's different. Because if you've done that same job multiple times, you've kind of seen all the different variables. You've seen all the different possibilities and permutations, and so you've got a slightly different perspective on it.
And you've seen the results.
You've seen results that you don't always have while you're doing it.
Especially when you first start doing it.
Especially when you first start and you're filled with theory, but you need some practice behind it. And even in the middle of it, when you have practice behind it, that's not always an end product.
You don't have all the answers.
And even if your answer is true, you might express it differently later. So, in biblical studies and in biblical criticism, it is extremely common for something like Isaiah to be broken up into at least three parts, Isaiah 1, 2, and 3, with the assumption that there were different authors. Oh, because if you look, the linguistic style changes, the word choice is different, some of the themes seem different, so it must be three different people. And I'm like, who in the world assumes that Isaiah, who talks about writing over the course of his lifetime, that someone who writes in their 20s writes precisely the same as somebody who writes in their 60s. It just doesn't happen. Pick up a Stephen King book. He's still writing. You know, he wrote some of his most famous works, 30 years ago, 40 years ago? He doesn't write the same way. And he's just a fiction author.
Yeah.
You know, the same person can write the same thing differently over the course of a lifetime. A lifetime that's full and rich and changes and stuff like that. Now, I'm not saying a black is white is black kind of change, but I don't have a problem with the same guy who wrote Proverbs kind of reflecting back later in life to say, well, you can follow all those Proverbs and it's good to do, but you know what? You still die in the end. Oh, well, that's dreary, but it's true. You know?
These kinds of things may happen on the way.
Yeah, right.
And that's something that an older person would be more likely to say than, say, a 15-year-old.
Or even a 35-year-old. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're kind of at the peak of your profession and you've got experience and you're talented and you start being asked to lead seminars maybe or give a talk to the new teachers or something like that, because you're kind of really at that, you know, you've you're kind of at your pinnacle in your 30s or 40s or whatever of your particular career. Well, but that's not actually the end. And another 10, 20, 30 years, your perspectives might have changed yet again. That's why I think Proverbs can be perfectly true, and the same guy can want to revisit them by saying, well, but they're not always enough. We just had our gospel reading about the Pharisees being criticized for tithing on their herbs and spices. And Jesus criticizes them for missing the love of God and his justice. But he says very clearly, you should have done the former without losing the latter. You do both. So the Pharisees are in trouble not because they're so detail-oriented, but because they've missed the big picture in only focusing on details. Proverbs can be true, and you ought to do them to live a wise, a life of godliness, but there's also this kind of overarching reflection on life as a whole that sort of fits with it in kind of a funny way.
Experience just that at 10 o'clock this morning.
I almost want to say that Ecclesiastes says, lighten up.
Lighten up, Francis. Yeah.
Lighten up.
So, Ecclesiastes, he was relating it to like encountering like existentialism for the first time. He's, you know, as a college student, he's reading Camus and all this kind of stuff. It's really sort of blowing his mind. And to me, this is sort of Yancey again, where he's, you know, raised in a very fundamentalist background, and then he sees a different perspective for the first time, and it really blows his mind. That was not my experience, so some of these things just don't seem quite as shocking to me, maybe. But one of the things that I thought was really fantastic to point out, with a lot of detail, and even drawing from these other authors and time frames and time periods, is the sense of meaninglessness. All is meaningless, all is vanity, whatever. Those don't happen in times of great crisis. They happen in times of great success. It's at the pinnacle of your civilization where people are bored, where people are wondering about the meaning of life. When you're struggling to eat enough every day to live, you're not really so worried about these philosophical things.
Right.
It is, so one of the jokes nowadays is, well, you know, such and such is a first world problem. You know, you apply that statement when you're frustrated by something, but it's actually a pretty minor frustration, and it's built on an overall life and culture of plenty. You know, that you go to the coffee shop, like a Starbucks or something, and they mispronounce your name when you're getting your coffee. Well, that's a first world problem. You know, I'm so annoyed that they can't get my name right. Okay, but you know, that's not like a real problem. That's like when all your other problems are solved, then these things start to bother you. So when you consider some of the things that bother people today, read the paper, go online, you know, watch the news. I mean, there's some stuff that people are just going to lose their minds about. You go back 100 years and people will assume you are insane for being worried about that. What do you mean you're worried about that? There was a kind of a funny meme I just encountered the other day about political civility, and somebody, the quote was like, you know what, America needs to go back to an earlier time of political civility where, you know, we weren't using such hurtful words as, you know, in Congress. Instead, we were dueling with pistols. Like, there were a couple of arguments in Congress settled with pistols. Like, they had a duel in Congress. That's bad. when you shoot your opponent.
Yes.
Calling your opponent, you know, a dirty crook somehow seems a lot less significant in comparison. Oh, but my feelings, it hurt my feelings. We have spent a generation and a half, if not two, doing our level best as a society and culture to protect the self-esteem of children.
Yes.
That we want them to hear words of kindness and words of praise and words of how unique and special they are and that they can do anything and everything and protect them from harm and danger and make childhood a safe and nurturing time. And
protect them from failure.
And we are now seeing an entire generation and then some of, statistically speaking, the most fragile, the most psychologically ill-adjusted, and the most depressed we've seen in American history. So we've tried to make everything a success. And in doing so, they have no ability to cope. They can't withstand. There's no perseverance.
That's it. They don't. They're not taught to recognize failure.
Or success.
Well, but failure is just not an option. Not in the sense of right. I'll try harder.
No.
If there's failure, something is wrong and it's got to be fixed.
That's right.
Because I can't fail. I'm not allowed to. I'm not permitted to.
That's right.
And I'm not saying that people have to go around hurting each other's feelings. I'm all for kindness and wisdom and prudence. But the entire concept of trigger warnings and safe spaces and snowflakes and all this sort of stuff, like, was college that long ago for me? I mean, I seriously remember most of my professors thought it was part of their job to shake your preconceived notions. Like, that was a real open thing, like, oh, you go to college and they're going to challenge your preconceived notions. You do that today and you're going to be sued. You're going to lose your job.
Yeah.
You can't tell me something I disagree with. And it is, we've accomplished the exact opposite of what we've hoped to do. By having a life that seems to have all the trappings of success and safety and nurturing and everything else, what we have reaped from that is actually anxiety and weakness and fragility, and people are actually more disconnected relationally from each other than they ever have been. There is a Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist, and I listened to some of his lectures and things, and it's very interesting. And he's taken an idea from somebody else, and he's kind of been working on extrapolating some principles about it. But one of his things is what he refers to as anti-fragility, that there are certain systems and things that are anti-fragile, meaning when something is fragile, if it breaks, it's easy to break, and when it breaks, it's no longer fit for its purpose. Like you drop a glass. Glasses made of glass are fragile, they break, and then once they break, you can't use them as glass anymore. And then you have things that are durable, like maybe that glass is made of stainless steel, and you can drop it all you want, and it doesn't break. Maybe it'll dent, but it's, you know, it's always, it can just kind of take a battery. But anti-fragile is something different than either of those. It's not necessarily durable, it's not necessarily fragile. Anti-fragility is more like, say, your immune system. Your immune system must be tested in order to become effective. You have to encounter viruses and bacteria so that it can create the antibodies to be successful against them later. It's like how bones become stronger when they break and are re-knit together, or how muscles get bigger when they are broken down through exercise and exertion. There are certain things, and they're mostly kind of biological, that actually do better under stress. You need the stress, you need the failure even, for them to become better. They're anti-fragile in the sense of you ought to be breaking them, because when you break them, it becomes more fit for use.
But we have to be trained to do that. We have to have that pounded into us.
Maybe.
That's the opposite of saying.
But I will say.
You can't fail.
But I will say, without a lot of training, every other human culture has done this. You know, since prehistory, there were no books like teaching, oh, when you have children, you can't let them go work out in the fields. We need to eat and live, so you go work out in the fields just like I do. You know, so you weren't.
But that's part of the training. Absolutely.
I guess if you're relating training as more of a. Just an unspoken cultural thing, then yeah, I agree with you. But I would say, I mean, our natural state is anti-fragile in the sense of it's only occurred to people very recently that we should be doing something different than encountering and experiencing difficulties and overcoming them.
And maybe that's because we were trained previously to respond in that fashion.
Maybe, but I think when I start talking about natural state, I think like if you are born on the deserted island and your parents die when you're very young before you can be trained, and you just have to learn how to survive, you survive in a natural state in an anti-fragile manner. You either live or you don't.
You already know that. You might perish.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying if you survive, You the only training is the training that of your own experiences.
Well, look at the movies that supposedly happens, and the child becomes animal-like.
Yeah.
Because the animals care for the child, and they walk on all four, and they have a language, but it is not a language that humans can really understand.
Again, they're taught.
I think that. I wouldn't disagree with you about being taught at some level, but I think it's maybe deeper than that. Like, the teaching is almost the explanation. It's not the reality. You know, life is full of challenges. We don't have to be taught to encounter them. We simply do. And what we're taught is maybe a perspective on it, some techniques about it, or whatever. It's kind of like there's an economic principle that poverty comes from impoverishment, the not having something or the taking away of something by the rich or the wealthy or whatever. And in its most technical sense, poverty is the natural state of man. We are born with nothing.
Right.
And unless we gain it somehow, it's given to us or we make it or achieve it, you will have nothing. So our natural state is actually having nothing. So we are, you know, we inherit a lot of stuff because we're born in this particular society, or we're born to parents, or what have you. But in its most technical sense, we come into this world with nothing. And anything we get from that point on is not our initial natural state. So, I would just say in a broad sense, we would encounter, regardless of what we were taught, we would encounter challenges that we would either overcome or not. But it's only recently where there's been more thought and more purpose given to the training and the teaching. And unfortunately, the training and the teaching over these past couple of generations has resulted in the opposite intended effect. And it's not unlike Ecclesiastes with the thinking the big, depressing existential thoughts doesn't come when you are struggling to overcome. It comes when you've already made it. And then you start thinking, well, now what? There's a couple of great historical lines I'm thinking of. One of them is John Adams, who is talking about how he's raising his son. And it's something like, I am learning war so that my son can learn law. And he will be learning law so that his son can learn poetry.
His son can learn what?
Poetry.
Poetry.
The idea that, you know, when you don't have, as like when your society's first starting out, Revolutionary War. So I need to learn the basics. I'm going to have to fight. But I want to fight for a free country so that my sons don't have to fight. And that his sons will be the beneficiary of a generation that didn't have to fight. And so on and so forth. I study warfare so that my son won't have to study warfare. He can study something like law. He will study law to establish this good and just society so that his son doesn't have to worry about it. It's already been done. He can then pursue more creative and intellectual things. And so we all do that. You know, we all want our kids to be better off than we were.
Yeah.
But you know, a lot of us maybe have experienced you give them too much and you find out some of who you are occurred through the struggle. And there was something good in that.
But
and
they
didn't receive it.
They don't receive it.
You can give them too much.
You can want your kids to have more and do more without giving them more.
True. That's true.
Yeah, but you're unique in that.
But I would say the temptation is a very easy one. I don't want you to struggle the way that I did, so I will prevent that.
And in
preventing that, that's actually good, but there is something potentially lost in that. I'm going to take a more benign example, which is, not benign. It's actually kind of emotional for me, but it's not, you know, giving them a lot of stuff, sort of, so to speak. But my dad never had a birthday party. Was never given anything for his birthday. Never give anything for Christmas. Very poor, big family. And that always bothered him. And so he had kind of made a decision, my kids will always feel special on their birthdays. And when I was young and we didn't have very much, he still went out of his way. And that became an ethic within our family.
Mm-hmm.
You made that other person special on their birthday, Christmas was, holidays were special, all that kind of stuff. You know, to this day, I make breakfast in bed for whoever's birthday it is, or for Mother's Day, or, you know, whatever. It's the day sort of starts up, and you have gifts, and the whole goal is, oh, they're going to pick what's on TV, and whether it's a financial thing, or whether it's just a perspective, I want that person to feel special on their birthday, it's because he never did. And I was raised in the benefit of his choice that I wouldn't know what he knew. Now, I have carried that over naturally with my own children, but they're now two generations removed from why, and they don't understand why. I did, at least a little. They don't. And even if I explain it to them, they still don't kind of get it. It's a lot easier for them to maybe grow up and get married and start their own family and lose some of these traditions because they didn't have to fight to earn them.
Exactly.
Living through an experience
is
different than being told about it.
Oh, so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah. You know, the most important things in life, I would say, you can't read a book on it and understand. You have to just do it.
And you can think you understand it after reading the book, but when you go to do it, you find
it's always
out.
A little different, isn't it?
Recipes are famous for that.
Oh boy.
Well, I think that's kind of an excellent, that's sort of an excellent point, that recipes are very precise by nature. You don't tend to see many recipes anymore, at least it's like a handful of this, a dash of this, and just enough of that. You know, that's maybe how we were taught by our grandparents, who, as they were cooking, but you actually read a recipe, and it's usually very precise. And the reality is, it's difficult to have that kind of precision in life on a consistent basis. There's always something that's a little different. Oh man, this didn't work out, but I followed the recipe.
I'm thinking about something I did just recently. When they tell you to whip eggs to a stiff peak.
Yeah.
Well, how stiff do they need?
How stiff? Stiff. And you can over whip them, and it completely changes the structure.
Yeah.
And when did you get just too far? Or when is the humidity in the room just enough to throw things off? When is the altitude just enough to throw things off? When is the temperature in your oven just enough to throw things off?
And that's true about everything in life.
Everything in life is slightly different, and you can't really make it exactly precise.
I really relate to what you're saying, your parents wanting a better life for you, because I remember my father talking about that. You know, we were raised on a farm. But he believed wholeheartedly, if you wanted something, you paid for half of it. And I carried that into my children to a certain extent. And their father, there were stepchildren, and their father didn't believe that. So his children didn't have to buy half. And it created World War III. And I believed, because I had limited experiences in life, when I graduated from high school, I only knew you were submissive to your husband, and you did, I mean, my mother laid out my dad's clothes even when he went to the barn. He never even picked out the clothes that he wore each morning. And I had to learn, because my father died at age 17, I had to learn how to relate to men differently, because in the world outside of the farm life, which I graduated into by going to nursing school because that's where my dad wanted me to go, there's a whole new life out there.
Yeah.
And I tried to give my children different experiences, like taking them out to dinner once a month, because I wasn't in a restaurant until I was an adult. And all of those kinds of things, if you look back on them, that's exactly what we're talking about here. Every culture has its own way of being. And then if we don't let God direct that way of being, we still stay in that same straight line, which creates the poverty, I think. I mean, that's what I've kind of learned out of it.
Yeah.
And you only see it retrospectively. You don't see it forward. You see little pieces as God takes you through, and sometimes you don't even know it's God doing it. And I had a really good friend in California that she said, I don't ever remember not being a Christian. I was born a Christian. And she and I would talk about lots of different things, and she said, I can't relate to your life. And I had great respect for her, because she was a very strong Christian woman that was older than I, so I you know, could learn lots from her. But that was her take on it, when she would look at my life and try to help me live my life more like a Christian. And this really brings it forward for me.
Well, it is that sense of, it is in times of peace and prosperity where people start, like, depression and anxiety are very low in developing worlds. The suicide rate is very low in like countries stricken with a lot of poverty and stuff. It's the prosperous countries that have higher suicide rates, that have higher rates of anxiety and depression and all these other sorts of things. Basically, you have the luxury from your success and from your stability to start wondering, well, what's next? You don't tend to do that when you're just trying to struggle to survive.
If you have nothing, the survival instinct reigns. When you have everything, there is no survival required.
Yeah, and then the question becomes, yeah. Why survive?
Yeah,
it's one of the things.
Because you don't have to earn it anymore.
It's one of the things that I began to realize in trying to truly be a leader at Sandpiper is that I never can say it.
Millennials,
thank you, because I never can get it out right. Are the people that are moving in and they're extremely concerned about how we spend money. You know, they want to be in the midst of all the money. Now they're asking to read all the contracts. And much of the leadership is looking at that saying, oh, those nuts. And I pray about it a lot. And I think God is really honoring me in that I'm coming to realize it's foremost in their minds because they're the first generation that are not going to be wealthy. Hmm. In their retirement.
Maybe so.
And so we have to look at things a lot differently than we've looked at them before because we have to honor their lives long before we're going to be there or long after we're going to be there. And I think that's what we've been talking about.
There's maybe a little cynicism in Ecclesiastes. I would say that's more wry observation and a little world weariness perhaps, but it comes from this place of success. And when success doesn't answer all your questions, those questions seem to become more prominent. When you don't have it, but you're striving for it, maybe you can still assume that when I get it, everything will be better. Whatever that is. When I get that job, everything will be better. When I get that house, everything will be better. When we get out of debt, everything will be better. When I get that relationship, everything will be better, whatever it is. But then if you achieve it and everything isn't better, well then, now what?
Then you start looking at the bigger boat. The bigger house, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. The bigger.
And so sometimes it takes someone like Solomon, who has gotten as big as it gets, who can say, "I tried, and nothing ever filled that hole.
Yeah.
Nothing ever worked."
No.
You might not listen to some random guy who says it's not going to work. Well, listen to the guy who actually did it, who did all the stuff you're thinking is going to solve things, wine, women, and song, to a higher degree than you can imagine. And none of it solved the problem. There is an aphorism of life that I experienced firsthand, and it was one of my little early adult maturation processes, that when you go somewhere else, you still take yourself with you.
Absolutely.
I used to love going to Gainesville. We have family in Gainesville, and we would go for little, you know, weekends or whatever. And to me, it was peaceful and good and happy and just perfect, and it was an escape from whatever troubles I had at home in Orlando. And then I lived in Gainesville as a student, and then going to Orlando became peaceful and perfect and good and happy because my problems came with me. They were associated with me, not my location.
Yeah.
And so that was a difficult but a necessary lesson that changing your circumstances isn't going to make everything better. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean a good change of circumstances isn't a big help, because it can be depending on your circumstances.
And how does God say to solve that? I don't know that I know, but my point of perspective with that at this moment in time is you put the other person before yourself. You look at what is it that they need and try to find a way to have your needs met and their needs met. But I don't know that that's the true answer.
These are the words now, not of Solomon, but of Augustine, who's lived a similar life, who was the top guy in his generation. He was the smartest, the best, the brightest. And he too lived a life of wife, women, and song until he was humbled by God and eventually becomes, you know, we can theologian and saint and teacher and all that. But as a young man, his mother was just constantly terrified of how he was wasting his life and wasting all these enormous talents God had given him. Well, here's Augustine with, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. To find our rest or to find our fulfillment in the presence of God, not in our circumstances. That won't solve our circumstances, that won't solve all our problems, but what it does is it shifts our focus and from the circumstance of the problems, which might endure, frankly, to God who never changes and who is always there for us. We can't make everything better through changing our circumstances, so stop trying to do it. You can never fill that hole in your heart with anything other than the presence of God. So do that, and don't be expecting that the stuff or the things or the circumstances will give you some grand answer, because they can't. Therefore, they won't. All right, how are we? Good? Okay, so we'll take next week off. That'll give you 2 whole weeks to consider the words of the prophets.